We are talking today with Protap Chatterjee. He is executive director and managing editor at corpwatch.org. He is an investigative journalist whose articles have appeared in numerous publications, including The Financial Times, The Guardian, and The Independent of London. He has written several books, including The Earth Brokers and his latest book, Iraq, Inc., A Profitable Occupation. Protap, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Mike.
Let's start out. Tell us about CorpWatch.
Well, CorpWatch is a watchdog, and what we do is we hold corporations accountable. We look into corporate malfeasance. This might be fraud and corruption. It might be environmental abuse. It might be human rights abuse. And so we're talking about companies from Halliburton to Nike to Microsoft to even companies that, you know, may not be as well known and companies that sell products in the market. So we'll be looking into Tata, a big Indian multinational. We've been looking into First Kuwaiti, a company in Kuwait. And what we try to do is work with whistleblowers and provide information to the community and to policymakers and to the media about, you know, the problems of these corporations.
And what would motivate you towards a particular corporation? Would it be something you would see in the news, perhaps?
Or something we see in the news, but oftentimes people call us up. We get 2 to 3 whistleblowers a week. You know, so people call us up, especially because of our work on Iraq recently. People call us all the time and say, I need to tell you about the abuse of taxpayer funds. I need to tell you about my supervisor who fired me from my job. I need to tell you about the pollution of this water stream. I need to tell you about, you know. So we get a lot of calls from community activists, from employees, and we also try and track industries as a whole to see how things are changing. So we do more than just, let's say, respond to people's complaints. We look into shareholder activism. We look into trends in the law. We look into free trade and how it supports corporations, and we look into institutions like the World Bank. So we might sometimes look at things at a larger level, you know, put the context into what the corporations are doing, how they're transforming a country or its politics.
And what was the motivation in writing your latest book, Iraq, Inc.?
Well, the war in Iraq is a little unusual. It's very different from previous wars in the sense that so much of it is being done by corporations. So in the first Gulf War, what we call the first Gulf War, where the United States ousted Iraq from occupying Kuwait, 1 in 100 people was a private contractor. In the second Gulf War, the ousting of Saddam Hussein from Baghdad, 1 in 10 people was a private contractor. Today, it's close to 1 in 3 or even more than that in Iraq that is working for the U.S. military is a private contractor. So we've radically transformed how we do war, and a lot of it has been to the detriment of human rights. So there's been an evolution also in how money is spent and what it's being spent for, and that partly has to do with the nature of how the United States goes to war on other countries. And the way you can think of it is, in the Vietnam War, for example, there was a draft. Americans went off to fight the war, and part of their job was peeling potatoes, cleaning toilets, doing guard duty. Lots of jobs that people didn't really want to do, especially in a foreign country they never wanted to go to. It was hot, and people were, you know, there was gunfire, people getting killed. So now what we've done is we've turned a lot of those menial jobs over to private corporations who are often hiring sweatshop labor to do that job. So today, a lot of that work that was once, you know, part of basic training and part of, you know, what soldiers have to do is handed over to people to make a profit. And they are trying to ensure that they make as much profit as possible out of it. So completely new way of doing business. Not the private corporations have not been involved in war in the past. I mean, typically, you know, Lockheed and Boeing make the planes, they make the bombs, you know, and they provide the spy satellites. But what's different today is the sweatshop labor that are cleaning the toilets. It's the fact that going well beyond just that, there are people who are doing the reconstruction allied with an occupation, which you might think is a good thing, and one would hope it was a good thing. In reality, often, it basically serves the interests of the occupation as opposed to necessarily the interests of the Iraqi people. There's the provision of private military contractors with guns and interrogators who are there for hire that work for private companies, and finally government consultants who come in and advise the government. So we're having a new breed of war contractor, the military logistics. We have the guns for hire. We have the construction people, and we have the government consultants. So this is in many ways brand new. And so CorpWatch, in looking at this, is trying to expose some of the dangers fraught with privatizing war.
Well, I'm hoping we can go into some detail on these different new sectors that are reaping benefits from war, and talk specifically about companies and perhaps people those companies have hired. Let's maybe start with construction. We've heard that there's going to be numerous bases put in Iraq. A lot of those are permanent. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, there's two kinds of construction happening in Iraq. The construction for the military, and then there's the reconstruction, which is building of hospitals and roads and schools and that sort of thing. And these are both done mostly by big American engineering companies. To start with the bases, the U.S. was rumored to have plans to build 14 permanent bases. In reality, right now, I think they're probably looking at 4 or 5 major bases in the country. The bases that are being built, one of them, the biggest, is actually Camp Anaconda near the town of Balad in northern Iraq. And that's being built by Haliburton. It's done, actually. It's been built. And there are other ones. There's one in Anbar province, one in the south. I forget the exact locations. And then there's, of course, the new U.S. embassy, a $592 million, the biggest embassy in the world, the most fortified. And it's being built, you know, once again, using poor Asian labor in the center of Baghdad. So now a lot of that actually happens pretty efficiently, in the sense it's on track and on time because it's for the military. The same cannot be said for the reconstruction that's happening for the Iraqi people, which is the hospitals and the roads and the power plants and that sort of thing. Those are being done, you know, at a slow pace. They've been done badly. Much of the money has been wasted. And a lot of that stuff, unfortunately, gets blown up because, you know, there's this sort of active insurgency and resistance or terrorism or just common criminals that are blowing stuff up. So where the construction of the embassy and the bases, you know, was done in record time, Iraqis today have less water, less electricity, more sewage in the streets than before the occupation. And in fact, they're extracting less oil, and often as little as half of what they were pumping before the occupation today. So two tracks of construction, one going spectacularly well, and that's providing the military bases so they can do all the bombing. And another, which is providing services to the Iraqi, which is basically going nowhere and has gotten a lot worse. And in both cases, the people that are paying for it are paying top dollar. And the people that are paying for it are actually really you and me, the taxpayer, as well as the Iraqi people. When it comes to military spending, of course, that is our tax dollars that are paying for Haliburton to build these bases. When it comes to providing service to the Iraqis, it's a mixture of U.S. government money and Iraq's own oil revenues that are being spent. However, because a lot of these contracts are basically done through a system called cost plus, which means every dollar that's spent, or every $100 that's spent, you're guaranteed anything between $2 and $36 in profit. And so the problem with the system is now, of course, they say, well, if we didn't guarantee profit, people, why would people go work in a war zone? Well, the problem is because it's cost plus, there's an incentive to spend. So I know a guy who worked for Haliburton, and he worked in construction. He needed a forklift truck. So he went to his supervisor and said, I need a forklift truck. And the supervisor said, well, why don't you just buy 4? And he said, well, I don't need 4. He said, don't worry, it's cost plus. I mean, here's the problem. There is the ability to buy as much equipment as you want, because the taxpayer will pay and make a profit. Now, Haliburton actually only makes 2% profit compared to the amount of profit they make in the oil industry, which is more like 17 to 18%. It's not a lot. But if you buy 4 times as much equipment, you make 4 times 2%, which is 8%. You know, then you're talking about, you know, pretty decent money. So this is the problem with a lot of the construction, is we're paying so much money, we're getting very little back. Especially Iraqis are getting very little back in terms of services to them. And in terms of military bases, well, it really doesn't help the Iraqis very much, because basically it's being used to bomb them or to attack so-called insurgents and terrorists, which unfortunately has resulted in many innocent people being killed too. And this is something that, you know, I want to point out, that a lot of times these unmanned aerial vehicles, these smart bombs, they kill people. And when they kill people, there's often what's called collateral damage, and that's civilians is basically what it is. And that's actually creating a lot of anger and enmity in Iraq. You can look at the prisons like the Abu Ghraib prison, you know, is a lot of the interrogation there is done by private contractors. Well, I know some of those interrogators. I know people, you know, who've done interrogation, both good people who didn't believe in torture and bad people who want to do torture. And I know soldiers who've policed these prisons, and they tell me that 70 to 90% of the people in these prisons, in fact, committed no crime. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were swept up, put in prison, and now they're being interrogated and they're being held indefinitely. It's actually creating a lot of problems because people don't see, they see there are no services, they see their relatives are being bombed, and they see Americans sweeping them up and putting them in jail when they haven't committed any crime. It's creating, it is actually making things a lot worse for everybody, the Iraqis and for Americans. The situation is deteriorating as we speak. It's not getting better.
And a lot of this information that you share with us, you've gotten firsthand from people, as well as you've been to Iraq yourself.
Absolutely. I've probably been to the Middle East and Central Asia either 9 or 10 times. I forget, I was just there a month ago in January. And I've been to Iraq since the occupation a couple of times. I have traveled around. I've stayed in the quote-unquote red zone. I've visited the green zone. I've visited the schools, the hospitals, the power plants, you know, met with lots of Iraqis. Unfortunately, of course, the companies don't really want to talk to an organization like CorpWatch, so you end up spending a lot of time to ordinary Iraqi people. The military, partly it's their job, so they do, you know, so long as you fill out the bureaucratic paperwork, they will take you around. So I visited a lot of military bases too. So I've been there personally, both in Iraq and Afghanistan, surrounding countries like the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Kurdistan, Turkey, Uzbekistan, and going as far as, you know, up into Yugoslavia, where again Halliburton is running the military bases, to Kosovo and through that entire region. So I've spent a lot of time on the ground. I have interviewed both Iraqis as well as whistleblowers, people who work for the companies who came back. I have to admit, I'm part of the problem. I have a share in Halliburton. I am one of those people, you know, that's profiting out of war. My one share went up 50% last year, I'm embarrassed to say. But as a result of it, I get to go to the shareholders meeting. So I actually personally know the CEO of Halliburton, and we've had meetings and we've talked. So it's more than something that's you know, a Google search or a desktop study. I have been in the field. I know the management. I know the military. And when I was there not too long ago, in April of 2004, I was in a hotel, the Al-Fanar Hotel, and three doors down from me was a young American guy by the name of Nicholas Berg. And, you know, we're literally on the same floor at the same time. We left the same day. I went out with my Iraqi translator. He was a little naive and went out and got kidnapped. I shot some footage that ended up in Fahrenheit 9/11, and he got, you know, a month later, his head got chopped off. Those are the circumstances under which we reported and looked at this information and brought it back. But it's very much, you know, from the ground, from the actual, I spoke of, you know, of the fact that we use, you know, cheap South Asian labor. Well, I'm fully South Asian, half Indian, half Sri Lankan. I speak Bengali. I speak some Urdu. So I've been able to go meet with the workers myself in person. And like I said, I even know the interrogators on both sides of the fence, the people who believe in torture, the people opposed to torture. Some of which I can tell you about the people, some of which I can't actually tell you exactly who they are because I have to keep their confidences. But so it's very much from on the ground.
70 to 90%, that's not a number that gets out in the corporate media. Can you give us a sense for how many people are in these prisons and how many prisons there are?
There are, now I'm not an absolute expert in this, but there are upwards of 10,000 people, and I think it might be quite a bit more, but not less than 10,000 people. Abu Ghraib is a giant prison, but there are quite a few others. We actually have hired American companies like Parsons from Los Angeles to build a brand new prison so we can house all the people that we're arresting left, right, and center. And of course, there's the infamous Guantanamo prison where you know, many people were shipped from Afghanistan back in 2001. I've actually, in the course of my travels in Afghanistan, I went to Shibirgan, which is one of the, and the Kalajangi fortress, where they selected the people, and I got to interview some of the Taliban prisoners. And some of the people in those prisons, I don't think the people I interviewed, ended up getting shipped off to Guantanamo. And in the course of my work, I've been able to interview people who spent 3 years in Guantanamo as prisoners, both the interrogators and the prisoners, and who have subsequently been released because there was really no information on them. So it is... I was actually talking with a gentleman by the name of Jerry Levin. He used to be actually a journalist. He used to be the head, the Middle East bureau chief for CNN in Jerusalem about 10 years ago. And he was taken hostage by Hezbollah and held for a year. And after he came out, he realized and decided to quit the world of journalism and work on, he joined the Christian peacemaker teams and works, you know, very much in that area, in Iraq and Palestine and all around, you know, looking into these issues. And what Jerry was saying was that, you know, because actually four of his colleagues are now being held hostage, you know, he tried to explain what they were doing there, which is looking into the plight of the prisoners there, and then they got taken hostage. But when we were discussing it, it dawned on me, just thinking about Jerry's own experience being held hostage for a year, is that effectively, since 70 to 90% of these prisoners there have committed no crime by the documentation of the U.S. military itself and people who work there, is that these people are effectively hostages. We have swept people off the street, and we put them in these places, and we're holding them hostage. We're not providing information to their families. Sometimes, and this has been in the news a little bit recently, we have taken women out of their houses and held them hostage in order to get their husbands, to get them out of their hiding places and that sort of thing. But that's what we're doing there. Because we're sweeping up, I'm not sure that this is, some of it is deliberate, the sequestration of the women in order to be able to get at their husbands. Some of it is unconscious, inadvertent, chaotic, sweeping off people off the streets. But effectively, we're holding tens of thousands of people hostage there, and we're seeing the retaliation for that.
You have extensively covered the privatization of the people who do the interrogations and the translators. I'm wondering if you can talk about that. How did that start? When did that shift over from being a U.S. Army-supported activity to a private one?
That's a really important question, and one that is almost completely ignored in both the mainstream and even alternative media, is the privatization of intelligence. Something like 50% of the U.S. intelligence budget is actually spent on private contractors. Now, having said that, a caveat right there, a lot of this is the spending on expensive spy satellites, which costs a lot of money. But the new trend is actually hiring people to do interrogation, to do spying, to do support for this stuff in places like Iraq. And really the trend sort of began in some ways after September 11th. Now, again, once again, another caveat, it is not uncommon for the U.S. military to have, and the CIA to have, private contractors, and this goes back some time, because these are people, let's say, have retired from the service. They've worked at the CIA for 40 years. They become experts, they retire, and they come back as instructors. And that's one thing. You know, I'm no fan of the CIA, but I think with people who have experience who come back out of retirement to teach in a college and maybe a private contractor, it's not necessarily the root of all evil or some such thing. But we're talking about a completely different scale of things today. When the U.S. Went to war in October 2001 in Afghanistan and subsequently in Iraq, they realized that at the end of the Cold War, because they spent so much time spying and interrogating people, you know, all that had been basically wound down. They really had, you know, a few hundred people to do interrogations. And suddenly they had this influx of tens of thousands of prisoners or hostages that they wanted to get information out of. And they just couldn't do that. So they had to go and tap into the private sector. Now, the private sector was basically people who had done interrogation and might have retired originally or left service. You know, the military can leave at age 40. And now they've started to churn out more and more and more people. And because they don't have enough people that have retired, what they've done is they've hired the private contractors to come in and run their main interrogation school, which is in southern Arizona in Fort Huachuca, and have private contractors train the soldiers. So private contractors write the curriculum, train the soldiers in military intelligence and interrogation and even grade them. They go work for the military for 3 years and then they quit and then they become private contractors. So we're pouring all this money into the private sector. Now, there can be an argument made, and I've heard interrogators say, well, we need to do interrogation, not torture. We need to be able to get information from people that will help us in our war against terrorism. Let's assume for one moment that this is a good thing. But here's the thing, when you hire a private contractor to do intelligence, what they're going to do is they're going to give you the information that you want. That's their job. And I know a guy by the name of Bob Baer. He's a former CIA agent. There's a film based partly on his life, fictitious film, Syriana. So I was chatting with Bob. I said, so Bob, what happens when you privatize the CIA? He said, well, it's like if I go down to a car dealership and I say I want a Porsche, they're going to give me a Porsche. If I go down and say I would like information on weapons of mass destruction and I want proof that there's weapons of mass destruction, that's what they're going to give me. That's what I'm paying them from. You can't really privatize intelligence. It doesn't work. Once again, I don't condone or think that spying and the CIA and intelligence is a good thing, but let's assume that it is. If you privatize that, you're asking for a lot of trouble because people will give you information sometimes just to sell out somebody that they don't like. And this has happened numerous times in Afghanistan and Iraq. The American soldiers have believed in people they've met who are friendly with them, and they say, well, who's the Taliban here? Who are the Ba'athists here? And of course they point to somebody they don't like. And, you know, they get carted off to Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib or whatever. We have a real problem when we hand this over to people who have vendettas. And this, to come to other part of your question, the translators. A lot of the translators we're employing are people who speak the language, and many of the translators are people who are hotel receptionists who spoke Arabic, or they were working in a 7-Eleven, wanted a job, and along came these translation jobs, and since they spoke both Arabic and English, they got sent to Iraq. They had no military training. They didn't really understand about what they were doing. And I personally know people who were in charge of these interpreters, you know, in the Sunni Triangle. And they said, well, these guys were there for the money. They were there for the wrong reasons. And therefore, they did a bad job. They may not necessarily be bad people, per se, but, you know, as they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Well, if you're there with bad intentions, think how bad, you know, how awful that could be. And so you had people, there was this guy who was hired as a translator at, I forget where, I think he was in Guantanamo. He had failed out of military interrogation school in Guantanamo, and he was hired because these companies were so desperate to hire people. If you called them and said, hey, I've trained in the right place, I have these qualifications, they said, come on down, and they send them into the work. There's this guy, his name is Steven Stefanowitz. Now, he was a qualified military intelligence specialist. Steven Stefanowitz had trained at Fort Huachuca, and he applied for a job doing interrogation and arrived in Abu Ghraib to do interrogation. Now, he had the right clearance, he had top security clearance, and he was trained in the interrogation school. But he was not trained in interrogation. He was trained in imagery analysis, which is looking at satellite photographs. And he was assigned to do interrogation. Not having experience in this business, he did it wrong, you know. And he's one of the people being charged with abusing the prisoners. I do want to say that it's not just the contractors that have abused prisoners. A lot of the problem lies with the military itself. And so there are good contractors and they're bad contractors. And I don't think that contracting is the way to go. I think it's problematic per se because these people have to make a profit. But I do want to point out there are a lot of military interrogators, you know, and we've seen this on television, you know, Lindy England, you know, Charles Grainer, I think his name is. A lot of the people being prosecuted now were not private contractors. They were military people. The problem is the oversight of people, whether they're private contractors or their soldiers, you know, if they're allowed to do whatever they want, you know, in a situation where they have absolute power of an individual, they are going to take control of that person and they may well abuse that power. And that's what we're seeing today. And it's even worse when you're handing it over to a private company whose real bottom line is making a profit.
And it's my understanding there's no regulations or laws that we can hold over these private contractors.
That's not entirely true. There are laws. However, there's a difference in the way. If you're a soldier and you abuse a prisoner. You can be court-martialed. You kill somebody, you could face, a pretty lengthy jail sentence. If you're a private contractor, you lose the contract. You got to go work somewhere for somebody else. Actually, because there were so many abuses in places like Bosnia, there was a company called DynCorp. This is the company in charge, by the way, of training the Iraqi police. When they were in Bosnia, their employees were running child smuggling sex rings. I'm not saying the DynCorp ran it. I'm not saying the company did, but their employees did. So this company, abused, and all the military could do is fire them. They couldn't really do anything beyond that. So recently there have been new laws in the books. Nobody's been prosecuted under them. And the things, you could have laws in the books, but if people aren't punished or prosecuted for it, what good is that law? So this is the problem, is that the worst that can happen is they can lose a contract. If they've stolen money, they may have to pay it back. They may go to jail. But it's very different from military justice when it, in fact, is actually meted out properly, where you can get court-martialed and things like that. So less ability to do that. In the case of military intelligence, there are rule books they have to follow. And the rule books, of course, that are publicly available, there's the Military Manual of Interrogation, it's number 3452, lays out some fairly strict rules. Now, what happened in Iraq was the military added another 10 rules that wasn't in the original rule book, which included what anybody in reasonable mind would call torture. Now, they didn't tell us about it, and they said, well, we never really implemented it. But yeah, we did include some extra rules that included things like waterboarding and all these other things. I mean, the rules are amazing because they said it's okay to hold people in stress positions, etc., so long as you give them a 10-minute break each hour. Who is there monitoring to make sure that they had 50 minutes of torture and a 10-minute break? I really don't know. And I really think that the thing is, they weren't even doing that anyway. But some of these rules are just, put in, because they felt like they needed to have something on the books, but there was nobody implementing it. The people who've been charged with these problems are, getting 3-year sentences, Meanwhile, somebody, Saddam Hussein's government, we're sending them away to jail, and we're pursuing them, we're paying bounties to kill these people. There's a real disconnect with the way we treat people, in Saddam Hussein's government, who rightly should be prosecuted, and American contractors and American military who have abused Iraqis or American taxpayer dollars.
Could you name some of the specific companies that are doing the interrogation and maybe tell us a little bit about each of them?
Sure. The main company doing interrogation in the first year of occupation was a company called CACI, C-A-C-I, based in Virginia. Originally it was in California. CACI, however, has claimed, and I'm assuming that they're telling the truth, that they've gotten out of this business. The new company doing this is Lockheed. Lockheed now, basically, as far as I can tell, and they won't talk to us about it, and the military won't talk to you about it, I spend weeks and weeks calling people in Guantanamo, calling, people in Abu Ghraib, and calling people in Bagram, literally, calling the interrogators and the people overseeing them, and nobody would really tell me the answer. But there's actually an easy way to find out, because if you want to contract as an interrogator, you go to a website, I'll give it out on the air, intelligencecareers.com. So if you go to intelligencecareers.com, you'll find out who's hiring. And so I talked to the guys there, and I've checked out their website, and Lockheed is the company that's doing most of the hiring. So they're the big kid in the block. There's another company that does the interpretation, and actually more interpreters have been charged with abuse. And again, remember, because they're not interrogators, they're not necessarily have any military qualifications. And that company is a company called Titan, and they're based in San Diego. Titan was recently bought up by another company called L3, and it's one of these super anonymous companies. They're in Manhattan on, I think, 37th Street and 2nd Avenue or some such thing. But L3 also has a $500 million contract, $500 million, to do spy services for the U.S. government in Iraq. So they're doing translation, they're doing spying, these are companies some of the names are just so, out there and so anonymous that you never even really realize what they did. Because typically what they say is they say they do information computing, database work. So there's a company actually that was hired to do database work by a division of the U.S. government called the Department of Interior that I personally think of as, you know, the Smokey the Bear people, you know, the people who put out forest fires. So they had an office in a little town called Sierra Vista in Arizona. And in this town in Sierra Vista, they hired people to do database work. Now, the company that got that contract was bought up by another company, Kaki in this particular case, and the contract was used to hire interrogators. And they were sent to Iraq. And so I went to this office because I was really puzzled. I was like, first of all, how did this Department of Interior, forest fire kind of people, how come they were hiring interrogators? Well, it turned out that that office was actually right in the middle of the Fort Huachuca base, where they train all the military interrogators. I suspected that it wasn't exactly a mistake, that in fact somebody deliberately created a contract. I don't have proof of this. I do know that a civilian agency hired people to do databases, and what they actually did was interrogate prisoners, and Stefan Stefanowicz, the guy who's accused of abusing prisoners, worked for this company, Kaki. So you have to wonder if maybe this wasn't really a cover-up, whether this was not done deliberately in order to mislead the public. So these are some of the companies that we're looking at. And you know, there's a company called ILEX. You know, there's a company called, L3. They're, you know, all these companies whose names, they're not household names. I mean, Lockheed is a household name, but typically these are small companies who don't really want to tell you what they do because they're in the business of providing services to the IC, they call it, the intelligence community. And that's what we know as spying.
We are talking with Prothap Chatterjee. He is executive director and managing editor of CorpWatch.org, and he's also the author of the new book, Iraq Inc., A Profitable Occupation. Talk about the guns for hire contractors. You actually have on your website some amazing footage from employees of a company called Aegis.
Yeah. Well, Aegis is a company. They were hired. The U.S. government uses a lot of contracted private security, men with guns, basically, travel around, you know, and they are supposed to provide security to people working in construction projects, to high military officials. Paul Bremer himself, you know, who was running Iraq, had private security, a company called Blackwater. So there was many of these companies created throughout Iraq and in the United States and Britain especially. There were something like 60 of these companies that were set up and working in Iraq. Now, the problem is because there were so many companies and they all sort of, none of them wear uniforms. They travel around with guns and they shoot at people. In fact, there's a company called Zapata where the employees of Zapata were actually shooting at the Marines and the Marines threw them in jail. So here you have these sort of, you know, private security people just literally, you know, it's sort of ex-Marines gone wild or whatever with their guns. So because the U.S. military was having all these problems, they decided to, they needed oversight. So they hired a company to oversee the other companies. And the company they hired was this company called Aegis. Now, Aegis actually was a startup company, like a lot of these companies. So they had no real experience in Iraq. The guy who ran it, in fact, was thrown in jail in Papua New Guinea for trying to invade an island where there was a copper mine. He was found guilty of breaking British and UN law and supplying arms to Sierra Leone. This is the guy we hired to be in charge of all the security contractors in Iraq. His name's Tim Spicer. So his company does the oversight. The oversight is not, they're not in charge of inspecting how the contract dollars are spent. Their job basically is looking at providing information between all these companies and making sure they coordinate the activity. They also provided what's called close protection, executive protection. So they provided services directly to engineers or high military officials or what have you. Now, because the people they hire, they're really one of the worst of these companies. They had these guys, the particular guy who shot that video that you can watch on our website, www.corpwatch.org, was this South African guy. And so they would go out, and typically because either they're afraid or because they have guns and they think of themselves as somebody in a Hollywood movie set, if any Iraqi comes near their car, they shoot at them. First they shoot in the ground, they shoot in the air, and they'll shoot into the vehicle. You know, if a car comes close, you know, they shoot to kill. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners have been to Iraq, but in Iraq, traffic, there are no such things as traffic rules. People spend their entire time overtaking each other in traffic at 100 miles per hour because Saddam Hussein built these really good roads. It's one of the most terrifying places to drive. And then you have these men with guns who are really not used to this thing. They're driving at 100 miles per hour. They start shooting at anybody else who comes anywhere close. They have killed many, many civilians. I personally know people who have just shot at people who came too close and killed them. You know, and there are also a lot of, you know, just miscommunications. This is a little hard to do on the radio, but there are hand signals that the Iraqis use to indicate hello, goodbye, and things like that. And they're different from American hand signals. Some of the signals that we think are okay, you know, the thumbs up sign is basically an extremely rude sign in Arabic communities or in Afghanistan and places like that. Never do it. And what we would say when we hold up a hand to say halt, and you hold up, you know, your hand and show your palms up, that's basically saying hello. So people think, oh, well, we'll drive on. Whereas actually what you need to do is, you know, you need to put your hand together and say slow down. It's a completely different symbol that doesn't exist in America. So you have these guys wandering around. They speak no Arabic. They don't understand basic hand signals in Iraq. And so they're giving people the wrong signals, and then they're shooting at them when they completely misunderstand them. So this is what Tim Spicer's company was done. One of the employees of that company videotaped himself shooting at people, and then they passed it on as a joke. They put an Elvis Presley soundtrack underneath it and sent it around to their friends. And somebody posted it on the web, and we downloaded it, and we put it up, and you know, there's now an inquiry into this whole situation. But this is true of a lot of companies, both Aegis and Zapata, people wandering around with guns randomly shooting at Iraqis whom they perceive as a threat, whether or not they're a threat.
Yeah, I'd seen a recent Frontline special on private contractors in Iraq, and what was so mind-blowing about that is you read these accounts, and it's different when you're actually seeing the footage, and it showed a lot of footage of these guys going between, I believe, the airport and wherever they were based at. And you had a totally different sense for what, like, traffic is like. I mean, you imagine that it's like these villages in Iraq, but it's like major urban, you know, cities with thick traffic, just like we have here in Seattle. And these guys that are totally gung-ho when a car gets 50 feet, you know, these guys just start shooting.
They start shooting at you. That's exactly right. And there's really nobody to rein them in because, you know, they're contractors, they're American contractors, you know, and so they get away with whatever they want, which is often literally murder is what's happening. So, I mean, the system has sort of gone haywire with, you know, these people wandering around. I mean, it's terrifying for when I'm there, you know, I'm more worried about these guys with guns than the American soldiers who, you know, point guns at you than I am about Iraqis because you just don't know when they'll, you know, they're trigger happy and they'll shoot at you. And we pay them lots of money for this. To travel that route, it's one of the most expensive cab rides if you travel by an American security company. It costs you $5,000 to go to the airport, is what it costs. Now, you could also take an Iraqi cab for about $15, but, you know, it's a little risky. And I was just in Dubai last month, and I was meeting some people getting on a plane, and I was like, so aren't you worried about when you get off the plane and take a cab? They're like, well, yeah, there's a couple of bombs here and there, and, you know, what can we do? We got to go home. And, you know, at first I was shocked, but actually thinking back, it's not that shocking because when I stayed in Baghdad, every morning at 3 a.m., there'd be mortars going off 300 yards away. You just see the smoke rising. That's life, and at some point you get used to it, and it sounds terrifying and horrible, but that is the reality of life in Iraq today. And a lot of it is due to trigger-happy American contractors running around with guns. And that's not to say that they're the only people killing and blowing people up. Absolutely not. The American soldiers are doing it. There are common criminals that are doing it. There are insurgents that are doing it. But it adds to the mix. And they're the most easily identifiable, and they create a lot of resentment.
And a lot of these employees of these companies are as well coming from other countries. They're getting their military
from all over the world. A lot of they're Americans working there, but they're Nepali Gurkhas. There are a lot of ex-British special forces. There are also people from South Africa, Chile, and El Salvador, literally from the death squads, from the old apartheid regime. In Iraq Inc., in my book, I talk about three different individuals who died. And because at the end of the apartheid regime in South Africa, there was a process called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, by which everybody who's part of a death squad, you know, recounted what they did. So it's been tabulated by their own admission. Three of the people who died in Iraq, when we looked up their names, we found that these were people involved in death squads and assassination efforts in South Africa. These are the people who are going to Iraq. I was just on in an email. I'm on some of these military listservs of the private military contractors, and just yesterday, there was an email on one of our listservs from a guy from El Salvador who was saying, "Oh yeah, you know, we trained at Fort Benning in the School of the Americas. You know, we know the American way." There were Chileans, and they were saying, you know, the Americans were saying the Chileans are better than the Salvadorans, and somebody's saying, well, the Salvadorans are pretty good at this job. They also trained at the School of the Americas. Those are the people that are out there doing these jobs.
Talk a bit about Blackwater, because they got prominence a couple years back. They were the four people that were hung up on that bridge and burned. And then of more recent note, I understand that they also were patrolling the streets of Louisiana.
Well, they still are, I believe. Blackwater is a company in Marcock in North Carolina, and they provide some of the most expensive and also some of the most experienced ex-Special Forces, Navy SEALs, Delta Force people to provide protection for high-ranking officials like Paul Bremer. Fallujah, the case of Fallujah was actually interesting in the structure of these companies and what they're doing. Most people think those people are working for Blackwater, and that's true. They're working for Blackwater, and here's a couple of different things. First, they're paid $600 a day to do that, so they're being paid a lot more money than if they'd been in the Special Forces themselves, because that would be, you know, a regular, you know, a high-ranking soldier's pay maybe a couple of $100 a day. So you paid a premium for it. So Blackwater sent the $600 salary plus their overhead, their administration, their profits, and they provided that contract. They were doing that work for a company actually in Kuwait called Regency Hotel, who in turn charged their administration overhead and profit to a company in Germany, whom they were subcontracted to, called ESS, who in turn provided that job and therefore administration overhead and profits as a subcontractor company in Houston, Texas, by the name of Halliburton. So the people, those four men who died, effectively were bodyguards for a Halliburton food convoy in Fallujah. This is something that's not really talked about very much. That's the job that they were doing. Now, they were, the families have complained in that Frontline documentary that you mentioned, which I actually helped on some of the production of. The family said, well, they weren't given proper protection. That's partly true. And one of the things that in that documentary that's actually very interesting, you know, this guy is there, you know, and the mother says, you know, my son, you know, worked in Special Forces. Really, there was only one thing he really knew how to do, which was to kill. And so when he quit his job in the military, he couldn't find a job elsewhere, so he went to work for Blackwater, and off he went to Iraq, and now he's dead because they didn't provide proper security. Now, some of those people actually, you know, lied on their resumes. The people who went Blackwater, and I know this in Fallujah, I know for a fact, were actually sort of horsing around and just, you know, showing off what they could do, and that's part of the reason they got into trouble. It's, even though they're Blackwater and they're supposed to be, you know, the top of their profession or whatever, they aren't that different from the Zapatas and the Aegises of the world, who you know, hire people with guns who are trigger happy, and that in fact has been a hallmark of a lot of these companies, including Blackwater. So now Blackwater has a lot of experience in doing this work, and so when there was the Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, the Department of Homeland Security hired Blackwater because they knew of them and their experience in Iraq, and sent them to New Orleans. And in fact, what's actually interesting, of a lot of the contractors in New Orleans, both private security as well as reconstruction, are the very same companies, Halliburton, Parsons, Fluor, that are working in Iraq. And what is amazing is, because the situation is so bad in Baghdad and they can't do much work because of all the things being blown up, when Katrina happened, they literally shipped their staff from Baghdad straight to New Orleans because there were these new $100 million, billion-dollar contracts to be done, and they could make more profit. And we're seeing the same problems in Mialls. We're seeing the overcharging. We're not seeing the interrogation that I know of, abuse, but we are certainly seeing the wasted public taxpayer money and the fact that people, you know, are really not getting proper services. I was in New Orleans last week, and when I was there, we went to the 9th Ward. Entire neighborhoods are leveled, and there's been no reconstruction, you know. There's this barge that crashed into this neighborhood. It's still there, you know. It hasn't been moved. So we're paying Blackwater top dollar. We're paying Halliburton and Bechtel and CH2M Hill and Floor and Parsons. And the only people that are actually building houses there are actually volunteer kids from Oregon showing up and rebuilding houses with their own, you know, bare hands for no money at all. I mean, it's a tragedy that we pay all this money to Blackwater. And the only people that are providing food and free food are, you know, kids probably from Washington State, as opposed to contractors. I mean, it's really incredible.
Let's go back to Halliburton that you had talked a little bit about earlier. The major media gives them some coverage, but doesn't seem to go into a lot of detail. And one of the things that I don't think really sinks into your average listener or reader is all the other subcontractors that Halliburton has control over. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Halliburton is actually the largest contractor in Iraq, if you exclude the people making the planes, the bombs, the Boeings of the world, and the Lockheeds. $25 billion had been spent on private contractors by about 6 months ago. That was the last time that I looked at the figures. And 52% of that money went to Halliburton. So out of $25 billion, something like $12 billion was spent on Halliburton. Most of that was not for reconstruction. It was mostly for providing military logistical services to the Pentagon. And so of that money, Henry Waxman, a congressman from Southern California, has got hold of a lot of internal Pentagon documents that show that out of that $12 billion, $1.5 billion is unaccounted for. Maybe it was spent properly, maybe it was not. We just don't know. There are the receipts. We know they overcharged. There was also overcharging. So it's a considerable chunk of taxpayer money. Enough money, that $1.5 billion is enough to pay for the up-armoring of every vehicle that's in Iraq. Now, I'm not sure that up-armoring vehicles will solve the problems in Iraq, but in just context of the amount of money. So we have a problem in the sense that this company, which, of course, as I'm sure a lot of listeners will know, Dick Cheney once headed up, is making all this money and spending it willy-nilly. What, of course, is interesting is that Dick Cheney today, we pay him roughly $200,000 in salary as Vice President of the United States. Well, he gets the same amount of money from Halliburton, and he gets it through a tax deferment scheme that allowed him to postpone the receiving his salary to 5 years after he left Halliburton. Now, I have to ask you, because I pay taxes in this country, and I assume that many of your listeners probably do, this man is willing to spend our tax dollars going to war, but he's not willing to pay his own taxes. I mean, this is Dick Cheney, the Vice President of the United States. And he's being paid by Halliburton, the company that is making, you know, billions of dollars in revenue and hundreds of millions of dollars in profits out of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, that's Halliburton for you. And they're overcharging. There was an instance where they were charging Kuwait $100 for a bag of laundry. Now, I don't know how much it costs in Seattle to do a bag of laundry, but I'm assuming maybe $5 and quarters or some such thing. Well, here's the amazing thing, is that same company was charging $15 at other military bases to do it, but in some places, because they could get away with it, they charge $100. So it's not even, Kuwait is not a dangerous place. It's not a place where, you know, you're under constant mortar fire. But in Kuwait, they were charging $100 a bag of laundry when they could have done it for $15 or probably even less. So they were subcontracted to Halliburton. I mean, this is the problem, is Halliburton knows it can overcharge and get away with it, and so they are overcharging and basically taking money out of your pocket and mine and providing nothing back to the Iraqi people, which is why the Iraqis are upset and angry. And, of course, they're employing almost no Iraqis whatsoever. Most of the employees are from other countries because they're afraid that, you know, Iraqis might blow them up. So it's this catch-22 situation. One of the new sectors that we're seeing in Iraq is this thing that I call the shadow government, and I don't mean it in any conspiratorial way. I simply mean that these are government consultants who work inside the ministries and whose job it is teaching Iraqis how to spend their money, teaching Iraqis about democracy. There's this classic company called Research Triangle Institute, and they're from North Carolina, and they were hired to teach Iraqis about democracy. So they show up in Iraq, and they bring in all these experts from other countries to teach Iraqis, you know, how to vote and that sort of thing. Now, I know a gentleman from Phoenix, Arizona. His name is Jabir al-Gharawi. He's an Iraqi man who hated Saddam Hussein, was involved in protesting Saddam Hussein, had to flee the country. Came to the United States, went to work in Phoenix, Arizona. He's a card-carrying Republican. He voted for Bush. He was in favor of the war. You know, so when the occupation happened, he said, I need to go help my fellow Iraqi citizens. So he got a job working for RTI, and he went to teach Iraqis about democracy. When he got there, he was a little disappointed. You know, here was he, you know, thinking, you know, we've defeated Saddam Hussein. I'm fighting on behalf of the American, I'm working on behalf of the American government. My president, George Bush, whom I voted for, you know, I'm a Republican. When he got there, and as an Iraqi who spoke the language, he suddenly realized that all these people were doing was sitting around watching satellite television and spending 90% of the money on themselves. He was in charge. It's a little odd, but he got a job setting up a women's NGO. Anyway, we won't comment on that itself. But his salary was $80,000. The budget of the women's NGO, the entire NGO, was $90,000. He set up the NGO, and then one of the women in it got shot and killed, and so they shut down the women's NGO. So all the time he spent, the 9 months he spent there, were for naught. He went and got and talked to people. They insisted he had to go with these private security guards carrying guns. And so when he went into the communities, people wouldn't talk to him because they were afraid of the private security guards. He's like, look, you know, I'm Iraqi. I know how to talk to people. I know what to do. He came back extremely disillusioned because he said, you know, we're not really teaching Iraqis about democracy. Now, what's happened is this company showed up, and instead of creating elections, they had this process called selections. And in selections, they selected the people that they thought would best be able to govern the community. They selected from the pool of people who came to them. And the pool of people who came to people were people who wanted contracts from the U.S. government, you know, who wanted to make money out of it. And since the way they RTI went about the business of building up government was they provided municipal services like sewage and that sort of thing, they had plenty of people to choose from. But they were the people who collaborated with and wanted contracts from the Americans. They didn't really represent the people who, let's say, upset with the Americans. They didn't really represent the people who were maybe represented the community because they were from the right religious community. They were simply the people who wanted to make money. And so the people who they hired and the people they appointed were, in fact, the friends of the U.S. government. So it was a disaster in the making. Now, compounding that was the fact that the Pentagon showed up and set up their own selections of public officials. So you had this incident in a town called Taji near Baghdad, where you had two councils operating, one appointed by the private contractor and one appointed by the Pentagon. You had another in Sadr City, which is one of the most conflicted parts of Baghdad, where you had an RTA-appointed council and then one elected by the local people, you know, and these two went to war. They started killing each other. So the place was just chaotic. It was a complete mess because we handed out the business of government to these private contractors and said, well, why don't you go ahead and do this? Another company we hired was this company called SAIC, and everybody listening to this radio show probably doesn't know about this company, but are somehow affected by the company. SAIC from San Diego, they're the company that provides the technology to read your email and listen to your voicemail. The whole controversy on, you know, the National Security Agency spying on citizens' voicemail and email, SAIC provides that technology. Well, they got the job of running Iraq's television network. Now, I have to concede that they have some experience in doing television. They ran the security cameras for the Olympics, but they've never done broadcast before in their lives. So they got a budget of $15 million, and they spent $82 million, that $15 million, in the first 6 months. Now, I'm not very good at math, but it sounds like they overspent. How did they overspend that money? Out of the Iraqi employees, and I went and visited, you know, the television facility a couple of times, the Iraqi employees were getting $150 a month. So they went on strike. because they were being paid so badly. The American consultants were being paid $200 an hour. The executives were importing armored Humvees, which the Pentagon said they were not allowed to have, on private aircraft to come in. Guess how many people were watching their television broadcasts? Well, less than 10%. When I walked into the television station, what was the front desk watching? They're watching Al Jazeera, and that's what most people watch in Iraq. Now, because we have free trade, anybody can buy a television. They're buying television sets and they're all watching Al Jazeera, including the employees of the propaganda station set up by the U.S. government, run by this psychological operations contractor for the CIA.
All of this sounds much more horrifying than what we're getting in the media. Do you see any solutions to any of this?
Well, I think the first solution is Iraq needs to be run by Iraqis. And I know the Bush administration pays lip service and says, oh, well, we're helping elect a government and we're going to train up the police and then they're going to be able to take charge of the country. Well, maybe this is hindsight, but as somebody opposed the one in the first place, we shouldn't have invaded and broken these things in the first place or disbanded the army. But Iraq needs to be run by Iraqis themselves. They need to be rebuilding their own schools. They need to have the local jobs. They need to have control of their own money. And until that happens, things are not going to change. Now, a lot of people say, well, there are these terrorists and there are these insurgents in Iraq. And it's absolutely true that there are people who deliberately set out to, you know, attack civilians and Americans. Now, of the attacks that take place in Iraq, 90% of them, between 70 and 90% of them, are directed at American soldiers. Now, 90% of the casualties are not Americans because the Americans have, you know, relatively speaking, better armor than the average Iraqi citizen. Last year, 800 Americans were killed in Iraq. And probably, you know, 10,000 Iraqis died. And the reason is Iraqis, ordinary civilians, have no protection against bombs that might go off. But the reality of the matter is that the violence on the streets is aimed mostly at American soldiers. If there were no American soldiers there, they wouldn't be being attacked. And it would make the place a lot more safe. Now, the other problem, of course, is there's common criminal activity, and there's a lot of that. Part of that is because Saddam Hussein let every common criminal out of jail before the U.S. invaded. Smart on his part, disaster for the Iraqi people, disaster for the Americans because they, you know, they rob people. I mean, there does need to be, you know, an effective police force in Iraq. And unfortunately, the company we hired, DynCorp, that was the very same company that was, you know, whose employees were running child sex smuggling rings in Bosnia, is doing a very poor job of training Iraqi police. So until and unless that changes, things are not, you know, going to get much better.
How can people find out more about your organization?
The way people can find out more about war profiteering in Iraq and about fraud and corruption among corporations, environmental abuse or human rights abuse among corporations, is they can go to our website, www.corpwatch.org. That's corpwatch.org. If you're just interested in war profiteering, we have a subset which is called warprofiteers.com, www.warprofiteers.com. There's a book called Iraq Inc., which is available at your local independent bookstore or even through mainstream chains, which I won't name, but you all know who they are. I mean, I would like people to patronize independent bookstores, but you can buy it from a vast web-based bookstore on the web for probably $5. You know, it's not hard to get. You can get it with a click of your mouse or by going down to Elliott Bay Books in Seattle.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks again. Thanks so much, Mike.
We have just been talking with Prothap Chatterjee. He is executive director and managing editor at corpwatch.org and author of the book Iraq, Inc., A Profitable Occupation.